Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, One Person, One Vote Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 8th, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Evenwell v. Abbott. As required by the Texas Constitution, the Texas legislature reapportioned its Senate districts after publication of the 2010 census, formally adopting an interim plan that had been put in place for the 2012 primaries. Plaintiffs who are registered Texas voters sued the Texas governor and secretary of state, asserting that the redistricting plan violated the one person, one vote principle of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause by failing to apportion districts to equalize both total population and voter population. A three-judge district court ruled in favor of the state officials. On appeal, the question before the Supreme Court is whether the three-judge district court correctly held that the one person, one vote principle under the Equal Protection Clause allows states to use total population and does not require states to use voter population when apportioning state legislative districts. To discuss the case, we have Andrew Grossman, who is associate at Baker & Hostetler and adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Grossman.
You know, when you go to oral arguments at the court, frequently you expect to be surprised. Sometimes cases that seemed that they would involve minor statutory issues and very sedate arguments turn into very heated debates and very close communications among the justices and among counsel and so on. Well, this case was a surprising case, but it almost went in the opposite direction, and I think it was surprising in two respects. The first was that there were no fireworks. A lot of people, I think, have thought of this case as a particularly politically charged case because of its potential impact on electoral outcomes across the country. But despite that, it was a very low-key oral argument. And I think the second point of surprise was what seemed to me a very warm reception that the plaintiffs in the case, Sue Evenwheel and Ed Feniger, that their counsel received from the conservatives on the court. A lot of people, I think, going into this oral argument expected that the argument would be a rout for the plaintiffs and that they wouldn't necessarily see a lot of sympathy from any members of the court. But what we actually saw in the argument was really a lot of interest and a lot of deep discussion about the meaning of representation in our democracy, about the power of the states, and about the different options that the states have and the different interests that they have to take into account when they draw electoral districts. Let's start with a tiny bit of background for those who may not be intimately familiar with the case. The case, Evenwell versus Abbott, is a challenge to Texas's practice, which is shared by pretty much all of the states, of drawing district lines based on raw population rather than voting population. Now, the result of that is that an individual's vote, the weight of an individual's vote, can vary wildly based on the number of non-voters included in different districts. In this case, the plaintiffs, Sue Evenwheel and Edward Feniger, live in districts that contain relatively few non-citizens. When voting in state Senate elections, their votes are worth about 50% less than a vote cast in Brownsville, Texas, which is right up against the Mexican border. All of the districts, all three of those districts, have about the same raw population, the same number of bodies. But the Brownsville district contains more non-voters, including undocumented immigrants. The result is that the people who are lawful voters in that Brownsville district have much greater voting power. Their vote is worth more than that of voters in other districts that contain more eligible voters. A lot of the sturm and drang over the Evenwheel litigation has focused on the potential electoral effects of shifting from what is in the past, since really the genesis of the one person, one vote doctrine, what has been a focus on just raw population data to a shift to measurements that account for voter population. And there are a number of different measurements that might do that. Some people have argued that the result electorally might be to advantage Republicans in some areas. Some have argued that it might be to disadvantage certain urban populations. And some calculations, including a brief that was filed in the case by a group called Project 21, looked at all the numbers and said, well, actually, it turns out that such a change might be a little bit bad for Hispanics, but it would actually be very, very good for black voters. So there has been a lot of debate over what the potential electoral effects of such a change would be. But interestingly enough, that's not really something that came up to any great extent, that came come up to any great extent at oral argument today. Instead, the court hewed and the advocates hewed very closely to the legal issue before the court, which is whether the one person, one vote doctrine requires states to equalize to some extent the weights of votes cast by citizens in their states. Arguing for the two plaintiffs in the case is Will Consovoy, making his second appearance before the Supreme Court. And Will had what I think was really a bravura performance. You know, in a case that was very difficult, that was very politically charged, and where there are minefields left and right with the sensitive issues of race and representation and voting rights, he had a very confident, very calm approach, walking the court through its own precedents and explaining how and really parrying a lot of very difficult, very targeted, very precise questions, particularly from Justices Sotomayor and Kagan. Let me run through a few of the areas that he addressed. His chief argument was simply that if you look at the court's case law over a period of decades, dating from Reynolds versus Sim, which was the genesis of this one-person, one-vote doctrine, while the court has used language that referred to raw population, and while the remedy in those cases has frequently concerned raw population, the reasoning of every single one of those cases has focused on vote weights. And it's not that unusual when you think about the historical context. At issue in that era, in the early 60s, was the Voting Rights Revolution. The court had recently issued a number of opinions striking down, what you might call first-generation barriers to the exercise of African Americans' voting rights, things like grandfather clauses and poll taxes and literacy requirements. And the court's decision saw one person, one vote as simply an extension of those types of cases and of the expanded and increasingly recognized and enforced right to vote on an equal basis across different populations. The court recognized that dilution of a vote, in other words, according one vote less weight than somebody else's vote, could be just as effective in terms of disenfranchising minority communities as any of those other first-generation barriers. Sure, it was more subtle, but it was something that could be brutally effective, and indeed that a number of states used. For example, some states declined to redistrict legislative districts for decades, with the effect that growing urban populations cast votes of very, very little weight, while rural populations that grew at a much slower rate saw themselves gain increased voting power. And that, of course, led to a racial disparity in voting power as well as in representation. And so as Consovoy explained, at the heart of one person, one vote has always been the right to vote, and that's something that the court has always focused on. When these cases have been brought, when one person, one vote cases have shown up in the courts, plaintiffs have had to demonstrate their standing, in other words, that they've suffered a cognizable injury that allows them to bring such a suit. And in every instance, it's been dilution of their votes. It hasn't been dilution of somebody else's votes or some kind of reduction in their representation. In other words, that the person who represents them is representing more or fewer other people than in other districts. So there's always been this very direct focus on voting rights. Will was asked as well about the apportionment of House seats, which is something that the Constitution directs be done by raw population. And this, of course, is just dividing the seats up among the different states. And as he pointed out, that was really the great compromise of the Constitution, and it really embodies a number of different purposes than the one-person, one-vote principle. Among them are simply the balance of power among the states and the federal government, but there are also issues relating to taxation and the state's traditional power to define voting qualifications. And it's not just the petitioners the plaintiffs in this case who make that argument. The court, of course, has rejected the analogy between one person, one vote type concerns and the apportionment of House seats in a number of cases dating back decades. But then the question shifted at that point to really what's on the other side of the ledger. On the one side, you have this idea of equal vote weight, and presumably there's some type of principle that underlies the other view. In other words, that raw population is the thing to be equalized. And the idea that the respondents in this case, which is the state of Texas as well as the United States government, which participated as an amicus curiae, the idea that they've come up with is equal representation. In other words, that there's some inherent right in having a representative who has about the same number of constituents as other representatives in the state, so that each person has approximately equal representation. But as the counsel for the plaintiffs pointed out, this actually is a little bit far removed from equal representation in the sense that regardless of how exactly you draw the districts, everybody has one representative. You have the same representation. The difference is that you may or may not have slightly more or less access to that particular representative. Presumably a representative who has more constituents may be harder to reach. Of course, maybe not. Maybe they just have a larger office staff. But the point is that that type of concept, equal representation, isn't something that's been recognized in any of the court's cases or really in any of the principles and doctrines that underlie the one person, one vote concept. It's something that, in a certain sense, is kind of new. There's dicta that one can point to in previous decisions that may seem to invoke that principle, but the court's reasoning and explanation of what it was doing has always been very consistent, and it's always been about equal vote weight. Justice Sotomayor, in particular, had several questions regarding the practical aspects of a requirement that states look at vote weight in drawing district lines, and in particular, the availability of data to do that. The census, of course, counts raw population, and there is at this time no citizenship question or other question that might help to elucidate in a precise sense the number of voters in any particular district. But it doesn't end there. The Census Bureau also conducts a survey called the American Community Survey, and that survey generates citizen voting age population data that's regularly used in Voting Rights Act cases, and it's also, interestingly enough, used in this instance and in many other instances by states that are undertaking apportionments so they can comply with their Voting Rights Act obligations. So in other words, the same district map that was at issue in this case, one of the inputs to that district map was, in fact, ACS-based data, in addition to general census data meant to equalize raw population numbers. The difference is that the Texas legislature simply didn't look at that citizen voting age population data at the time when they tried to set equality between the districts, at least within a certain parameter. The plaintiff's counsel, when his argument were complete, he was seceded at the lectern by Scott Keller, the Solicitor General of the state of Texas, which is the defendant in the case. And Keller's principal argument involved state sovereignty. As he explained it to the court, there are certainly a number of different interests here, including representation and including vote weight interests. But as he explained it, states get to define the nature of political representation. That is a core aspect, as he put it, of their sovereignty. This view immediately met with a substantial amount of skepticism. Justice Kennedy, in particular, asked Solicitor General Keller, why is it that if this idea of equal vote weight has if it is a legitimate interest, and it's an interest that is such that the state may trade it off against other interests that have been recognized as compelling and important interests, if it has that degree of importance to it, why is it something that states could, if they wanted to, just choose to ignore altogether and go entirely with the equal representation basis and do apportionment by raw population? I'm not sure that he exactly got a satisfactory answer to that question. And the Chief Justice and Justice Alito had similar questions as well. At the end of the day, Solicitor General Keller fell back on the idea that what the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause, which both underlie the one-person, one-vote doctrine, what they prohibit is not merely some type of discrimination, but in general, it's invidious discrimination. In other words, when a legislature or other government official decides to discriminate against a particular group of people for invidious and improper reasons. And in his view, if state could rationally choose to equalize representation, to equalize raw population. And that decision, even if it resulted in large disparities in vote weight, was something that simply wouldn't be invidious and therefore wouldn't be prohibited by the 14th Amendment. And in a certain sense, it's not an unreasonable argument, but at the same time, that's never been the way that one person, one vote has worked. The courts have always used numerical-based measures and have applied certain standards and presumptions that states generally have to work within to have apportionment plans that are considered to be lawful with respect to the Constitution. One interesting point was that Solicitor General Keller was compelled to agree that the data that would be available to do voter population-based apportionment is available. It's something states are using today, and it's certainly something that's possible that states could do in the future if they so chose to do it. And his intent, I think, in doing that was to leave the door open, but at the same time, it was something that potentially provided some confirmation of what the plaintiffs' counsel had argued earlier, as well as perhaps some degree of comfort to the justices that a decision that does require greater equalization of vote weight, something that as a logistical matter could in fact be carried out and indeed is the kind of inquiry that states are already undertaking. The last advocate at the lectern was Ian Gershengorn of the United States Solicitor General's Office. And he began by very strongly espousing the principle of equal representation. In his view, one person, one vote is all about the principle of equal representation for equal numbers of people. Of course, he was stopped in making that argument almost immediately by objections of the same sort that had been raised against General Keller regarding the weight and the value of the equal vote weight criterion. Nonetheless, he asked the court. His plea to the court was that it doesn't need to decide what it is that a state may do. In other words, the argument that Texas was making, that a state should have different options. In his view, it was enough for the court to decide that a state is not compelled to consider vote weight. But he added that if the court was going to consider what a state may do, that the U.S. government opposes Texas's view. In other words, in his view, in the view of the United States, a state can only rely on raw population data. It can only focus on equal representation. Any concerns about vote weight simply go out the window. On that point, he faced tough questioning by the Chief Justice as well as Justice Alito. Justice Alito's question was particularly pointed, and I quote, "It's your argument that voters are irrelevant?" And in effect, that was the United States government's argument, that even in cases of enormous disparities, that nonetheless states would be stuck using raw population. And he did allow that perhaps in certain circumstances, which were not really developed at all or very much in this litigation, but perhaps in certain circumstances, states could adjust those figures in some sense. But that also raises the question that if states are going to adjust those figures in some sense, presumably they're adjusting them to achieve some other interest, something other than equal representation, and presumably that would be in some sense equalization of vote weight. And so through the back door in that sense, the United States' position, while nominally opposing the equal vote weight criterion, nonetheless did give it some weight and some credence. A few general observations on the oral argument. To begin with, it was, as I said, low-key. There was not really any political invective. There was not really a lot of discussion about the results of the case, and there wasn't even a lot of discussion about the different effects, and how this is all tied up in the problem and the issue of illegal immigration, which is really what has driven the demographic interest in this particular problem. It's a key historical point that in the 1960s, as the court was developing this doctrine, there were very few lawful aliens in the United States, and there were even fewer unlawful aliens in the United States. And so the type of demographic issues we have now in terms of vote weight varying dramatically between different districts, it's something that at the time simply didn't exist. At the time, raw population was a pretty good proxy for vote weight and vote population. But over time, that's simply that has shifted and the facts have shifted. And in some sense, that's really the demographic shift that's underlying this particular litigation. That's why this issue arose now and not at some other time, because it's really begun to matter, and not only to matter, but to make a very large difference. Again, in this instance, as much as 50% variations in vote weight between citizens within a particular state. One unusual thing about the argument is that Justice Scalia was silent. Scalia, of course, is usually an avid questioner, but in this case, he had very little to ask. He's written before, slightly touching on this issue, and has certainly given some credence to the idea that vote weight is something that matters. But you know, one can certainly imagine that this is a difficult case for him. Some originalists are uncomfortable with the idea of the one-person, one-vote doctrine, and may view this case as presenting a potential for mischief and greater impositions on the sovereign rights of states, as well as other types of federalism concerns. At the same time, you know, the argument has been made the other way that, you know, that whatever the basis and genesis and constitutional standing as an originalist of the one-person, one-vote doctrine, that at least focusing on something like vote weight would make it would be more coherent and would also align it with the right that actually is directly and textually in the Constitution, which is, of course, the right to vote, which is something that a textualist would be very comfortable with. The government, the U.S. government, and to a much lesser extent the state of Texas, tried to play up the consequences and difficulties and dislocation and disruption that might result from a shift from a requirement that states take account of vote weight. In the view of the Solicitor General's office, thousands of jurisdictions would have to reconsider their plans, and they would have to do it based on data that, in the U.S.'s view, is incomplete and insufficient, and it would be nothing if not outright chaos. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way, and I think that's something that both the Chief Justice and Kennedy recognized and hinted at in their own questioning. The Chief in particular seemed to promote across several questions a compromise position that a state is required to focus on vote weight only when the disparity is extreme. The Chief suggested that something like 20% might be something that is an extreme disparity. And Justice Kennedy asked, why was it that a state couldn't simply do both? In other words, equalize raw population and then within certain bounds, in other words, 20%, 30%, within some threshold, get rid of the worst disparities in terms of disparities in vote weight. The counsel for the petitioners also suggested another point regarding this type of evidence and the burden, which is that in these types of cases, the evidentiary burden is always on the challenger. So at least as these cases are litigated, certainly in the short term before the next round of redistricting, in every instance, it will be on the plaintiffs to show that the districting plans that have been put in place by the states have these impermissible disparities in terms of vote weight. And it's not something that the states proactively necessarily need to work to address at this point in time. It's something that, except for in the most extreme cases, states may be able to skate by for a period of time. Interestingly, under the Chief's position, the idea of this disruption, the idea that there would be a great additional burden on states, it all kind of falls by the wayside, because when you set the threshold high enough, you can get rid of the worst disparities, but at the same time, the burden on states is relatively minimal for the reason that they already look at the American Community Survey data. They already look at citizen voting age population data when they're drawing their districting maps. So none of this is anything new. It would simply be an additional step that they have to take, an additional data set that they have to look at, but it's data they're already using in the same maps that are at issue in one-person, one-vote cases. So they wouldn't really have to do all that much more, if anything more. And as a final point, the plaintiffs in this case, at the end of the day, what they're asking the court to do is actually fairly modest. Not only is it this type of compromise position by the Chief and by Justice Kennedy, but it's also this idea that the court doesn't need to answer all these questions now. They don't need to figure everything out. The plaintiff's view is that it should be the state of Texas that gets to figure all this out. The state of Texas's law currently mandates the districting be done on the basis of raw population, and that's what's being challenged in this particular case. In the plaintiff's view, their preference isn't to have a court step in and resolve every single question under the sun and impose a new districting plan on the state. The idea is for this matter to go back to the Texas legislature and for the legislature to reach a proper understanding and a proper map based on the proper principles of law. And so particularly in this case, the court, I think, has an easy out. They don't have to answer everything. They don't have to come up with a definitive solution. They just have to say that at some threshold, too much disparity as a constitutional matter. And it's something that wouldn't disrupt the law very much, but in these areas where you have these enormous differences in vote weight, it could make a very big difference.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.